immigrants feel that they can speak out. But it's true, today, immigrants face retaliation if they speak out, if they organize protests. And that's something that we need to stop. So our government now, thanks to people like Jean, have recognized that that's true. They've recognized the importance of the First Amendment. We've seen it in Secretary Mayorkas's most recent guidance, saying that immigration officials shouldn't retaliate against people for using and exercising their First Amendment rights. But we have to see that a principle really be placed into action. Immigrants who speak out should be protected. They should not be targets for enforcement. If they are in detention and they are protesting the conditions of detention, they absolutely should be released. It's important for the entire American public to know what's really happening in our immigration system. And if immigrants can be silenced for speaking out about their experiences, that will never happen. So this is really important not only for immigrant communities, but for our entire country and for really protecting the values of our democracy.
Well, Jean, congratulations. Welcome home. Jean Montreville, Haitian immigrant and activist, and Alina Das, Jean's lawyer and co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at NYU School of Law. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gesner, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
La ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO. Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website, at KBOO.FM. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon health officials say hospital bed supply is waning as Omicron spreads in the state. Fred Meyer and QFC workers end their strike after reaching a tentative deal, and Senator Joe Manchin says he will not vote for the Build Back Better Act, deflating hopes for its passage. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 20th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. As the Omicron COVID-19 variant is surging across the country, health officials in Oregon are warning about how this may impact hospitals around the state. The first cases of Omicron in Oregon were identified in Multnomah and Washington counties on December 13th. Governor Kate Brown and public health officials said on Friday that we have about 3 weeks until they expect a surge of COVID-19 patients in hospitals in Oregon due to the variant. Given the way the Omicron variant has already spread through other countries like Denmark and the United Kingdom, Oregon health officials believe the surge is inevitable and are focused on reducing its severity by urging 1 million Oregonians to get their booster shots by the end of January. Health officials emphasize that even though there are breakthrough cases, you're less likely to suffer from serious illness and death if you're vaccinated, especially if you have a booster shot. With vaccines and boosters, medical professionals hope the prevention of severe disease will also provide some relief to hospitals already feeling the strain of a fall and winter uptick in COVID cases, along with other patients who still need care. The Oregon Health Authority reported data Friday that showed limited bed space in Region 1, which includes Multnomah, Clackamas, Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook, and Washington counties. Out of 369 staffed adult ICU beds, only 24 were available. It was even more strained in Region 2, which includes Marion, Polk, Yamhill, Lynn, Lincoln, and Benton counties, where there are only 4 adult ICU beds available. Fred Meyer and QFC workers ended their strike over unfair wages and benefits on Saturday after reaching a tentative agreement with the companies. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555, which represents 29,000 workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington, said the deal includes, quote, significant wage increases, added workplace protections, a secure retirement, and quality health care, end quote. The union said details of the tentative agreement will be made public after union members review and vote on it. The strike started at 6 a.m. Friday after union members claimed Fred Meyer and QFC were engaging in unfair labor practices, including refusing to give workers the pay increases they deserved. Employees walked off the job and picketed outside stores throughout Oregon and Southwest Washington, all of which remained open during the strike. The strike was originally scheduled to end at midnight on Christmas Eve, unless a deal had been met. Miles Ashaya, communications coordinator for the union, said, quote, "It's an exceptionally good deal. We could not have done it without the support from the community, and we really appreciate them coming out and having our backs." The deal won't be in effect until it's ratified, which is expected to happen at a later date that has yet to be set. Environmental groups scored a victory when the city of Portland denied permits for an oil-by-rail facility this summer. The plan to ship oil via Portland to ships on the coast could be dead for good this week. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
An effort to block an oil-by-rail facility in Portland could be solidified this week. This summer, the city of Portland decided to deny a land use compatibility statement for the Texas-based company Zenith Energy, which receives oil via trains, stores it, and then sends it to ships. Noelle Studer-Spivak is with Families for Climate, which is among a coalition of groups that have worked to stop the facility. She says people have been fighting it because there's been a dramatic increase in oil-by-rail traffic.
We are so grateful and heartened that we're actually looking out for the health and welfare of our citizens and not seeing companies from outside Oregon run over us and our well-being and our land use laws.
Zenith Energy says it plans to increase the amount of renewable energy, such as biofuels, that move through the facility. The company says its plans are in compliance with Portland's zoning codes and comprehensive plan. It has appealed the city's decision to the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals, which is expected to decide on the case on Thursday. Studer-Spivak says one of the biggest concerns is about any potential accident that could affect Portland neighborhoods.
I'm thinking particularly through Northeast in North Portland along the tracks. There are lots of frontline community members right there standing to lose the most if there were a major disaster.
Studer-Spivak also notes that most, if not all, of the oil coming into the terminal is not being used by Oregonians, but destined to refineries in Washington State and California.
Portland was bearing the most risk with the least to gain by allowing this transloading facility to continue operation right here in our community.
Studer-Spivak believes more communities should stand up against the shipping of fossil fuels.
I hope more people join the fight to hold this thin green line that keeps our oil in the United States and doesn't send it out to the rest of the world.
Studer-Spivak also is advocating for wide-scale adoption of electrification in Oregon to move it away from fossil fuels. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Jury deliberations began on Monday in the trial of Kimberly Potter, a former police officer who shot and killed Dante Wright during a traffic stop in a Minneapolis suburb in April. With more on the story, it's Sophia Muhammad with the Racial Reckoning Project.
On Friday, former police officer Kim Potter took the stand in her own defense. Potter broke down and expressed remorse for her actions.
I'm sorry it happened. I'm so sorry.
Through tears, Potter admitted that she did not intend to use deadly force against Dante Wright. While being questioned by prosecutor Aaron Elridge, She stated that she didn't recall saying, "I'm going to go to prison," after the shooting.
I didn't want to hurt anybody.
Prosecutor Elridge asked Potter what actions she took following the shooting. Potter admitted she did not render aid to Wright. Dr. Lawrence Miller, who was a psychologist, was also called to testify by the defense. He was asked by Potter's attorney to explain an action error and how that contributed to the shooting.
An action error is a sequence of responses in which an intended action has an unintended effect. You intend to do one thing, think you're doing that thing, but do something else, and only realize later that the action that you intended was not the one you took.
Miller explained to the defense that stress is what causes action errors, and in Kim Potter's case, mistaking her gun for her taser.
There's nothing wrong with that person's perception. If you put the two objects in front of them, they can easily tell the difference, but the perception isn't working. It's offline.
Outside of the courthouse, the family of Dante Wright and others pledged that they will continue to fight police brutality and push for legislative change. The prosecution and the defense are expected to make their closing arguments today, after which the jury will begin its deliberations. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Safiya Mohammed.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Former President Donald Trump filed a lawsuit on Monday against New York Attorney General Letitia James. The suit seeks a court order to halt James's long-running civil tax fraud investigation into the Trump Organization's business practices. The lawsuit accuses James of having exploited her powers, saying, quote, "Her mission is guided solely by political animus and a desire to harass, intimidate, and retaliate against a private citizen who she views as a political opponent." James responded to the suit with a statement accusing the former president and his company of repeatedly seeking to delay her investigation. James said, quote, "To be clear, neither Mr. Trump nor the Trump Organization get to dictate if and where they will answer for their actions. Our investigation will continue undeterred because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump." The unusual suit seeks a court order declaring that Trump's rights have been violated and a stop to James's civil investigation, as well as her involvement with the Manhattan District Attorney's criminal probe of his company. James has been investigating whether the Trump Organization committed fraud in reporting the value of certain properties to banks and tax authorities. James' office is weighing whether to file a civil suit against the company. James is also assisting the criminal investigation headed by the Manhattan DA into alleged tax fraud schemes at Trump's company. The DA's office charged the Trump Organization and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, with tax fraud earlier this year. Both have pled not guilty. James has denied that the Trump Organization investigation is politically motivated. She has said it stemmed from former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's testimony before Congress in 2019 about Trump business practices. Cohen was sentenced in 2018 to 3 years in prison for tax evasion and campaign finance violations. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia said on Sunday that he will not vote for President Joe Biden's Build Back Better Act, blocking the Democrats' goal of passing the nearly $2 trillion legislation to transform the nation's social safety net in the new year. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Democratic Senator Joe Manchin announced he will not support President Biden's Build Back Better Act, essentially guaranteeing it will not pass. Build Back Better is a $2 trillion measure that improves social, educational, and healthcare-related programs and protects against global warming. Specific components include 4 weeks of paid family or illness-related leave, universal kindergarten, development of new solar power technologies, building more than 1 million new rental and single-family homes, and creating a new surtax on multimillionaires and billionaires. It previously passed in the U.S. House of Representatives, though measures to expand Medicare and to pay for 2 years of community college were removed. All Republican senators appear to oppose the act, and the 50-50 Senate needs all of its Democrats to vote in favor of the bill. Some have called the act Biden's top goal, but other Democrats like Senator Kyrsten Sinema had already expressed reservations about voting in his favor. Rejection of the legislation might seriously damage the Democratic Party, especially during the upcoming midterm elections. Manchin said Sunday on Fox News that he cannot support the bill. He gave a 20-minute advance warning to the presidential staff. Manchin opposes the bill because of concerns about increasing inflation and the federal debt and the need to focus more on the COVID-19 pandemic. Republicans heralded this move. Progressive and moderate Democrats criticize Manchin, and some portray him as a deal breaker. There are even concerns he plans on leaving the Democratic Party. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi did not denounce Manchin by name in communications Sunday, but she did call for, quote, barnstorming the nation in the weeks ahead, end quote. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki called upon Manchin to honor his previous commitment to Build Back Better and to be true to his word. Manchin said, after almost 6 months of negotiations, quote, I cannot vote to continue with this piece of legislation, end quote. Some feel this wording does leave the door open to continuing talks with the Democratic Party and President Biden. For KBOO News, I'm Jar Salem.
You are listening to an end of year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st with your help. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be looking at the Greater Idaho Movement, which will be on the ballot in Klamath County in May 2022. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with some rain showers and a high of 45. Today in history, in 1989, the U.S. invades Panama in an attempt to overthrow military dictator Manuel Noriega, who had been indicted in the U.S. on drug trafficking charges and was accused of suppressing democracy in Panama. The U.S. invasion of Panama cost the lives of an estimated 500 Panamanian civilians. The Organization of American States and the European Parliament both formally protested the invasion, which they condemned as a flagrant violation of international law. The quote of the day is from American civil rights activist and Muslim minister Malcolm X, who wrote in his book By Any Means Necessary, quote, "You're not to be so blind with patriotism that you can't face reality. Wrong is wrong, no matter who does it or says it." Manchin faces backlash and praise for possibly killing the Build Back Better bill. A child tax credit extension may not be off the table, and voting rights legislation is punted to 2022. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
To have a senator that isn't focusing on creating the kind of investments that will uplift the communities that he represents is something that we need to seriously address.
Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and other Democrats blasted West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin after he dealt a massive blow to President Biden's Build Back Better Act. Citing concerns over inflation and rising debt, the conservative Democrat said he won't support the $1.7 trillion social and climate spending bill. The White House said Manchin's opposition is at odds with his recent negotiations with the president. The legislation needed the support of all 50 Democrats to pass the Senate, and Manchin was the only holdout.
Joe Manchin, I believe, will listen to the facts. The radical left could care less. They are on a mission to pass this monstrosity come hell or high water.
That's South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, who along with other Republicans praised Manchin's decision. Progressives still want the Senate to vote on the bill to put opponents on the record. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris sternly defended the administration during an interview when asked if Manchin or Biden is the real president.
It's Joe Biden, and don't start talking like a Republican about asking whether or not he's president.
Do you think Joe Manchin is a problem?
It's Joe Biden, and I'm Vice President, and my name is Kamala Harris.
Harris argued that Republicans are consistently blocking progress. Democrats were pushing to pass Build Back Better to ensure the extension of the expanded child tax credit for another year. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked last week about the possibility of a standalone bill that would extend the credit.
Of course, we could pass that in the House, Whether we could pass it in the Senate remains to be seen.
Nearly 9 in 10 children have benefited from the advance payments, which will now lapse. With Congress out until January 3rd, voting rights legislation is also on hold. But Democrats, including Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock, are again looking at ways to end the filibuster.
Voting rights are preservative of all other rights. They lay the ground for all of the other debates.
Democrats are calling for a federal voting rights law to counteract voting restrictions passed by GOP-controlled state legislatures. Former Senator Johnny Isaacson passed away at the age of 76. The Georgia Republican resigned in 2019, citing health concerns and was battling Parkinson's disease. Isaacson was known for consensus building and called for bipartisanship in his farewell speech.
Whether you're black or white, Republican or Democrat, whatever it might be, find a way to find common ground.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has tested positive for COVID-19. The 72-year-old is fully vaccinated and says she's experiencing only mild symptoms. And weeks after testing positive for COVID-19, Washington State Senator Doug Erickson died on Friday. The 52-year-old recently called Washington Governor Jay Inslee authoritarian for COVID restrictions. An official cause of death has not been released. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Federal agencies charged with managing lands owned by all Americans are partnering with the Hispanic Access Foundation's Mono Fellowship and Internship Program to bring more young Latino leaders into conservation fields. The deadline for applications, available at monoproject.org, is January 7th. Eric Gladys has the story.
The Hispanic Access Project is teaming up with the National Park Service, the U.S. Forest and Fish and Wildlife Services, and other agencies to diversify staff by tapping college students and recent graduates for Mono fellowships. Michelle Neuenschwander with Mono says fellowships provide Latinos valuable hands-on experience managing Colorado's wildlife and outdoor landscapes, which can help them compete for good-paying permanent jobs with benefits.
When candidates want to apply for these positions, some of the minimal requirements is asking for 1 to 2 years of experience in the field. You know, it's not an entry-level position, so these opportunities allow them to gain that experience to be considered for these positions.
Fellows work on cultural preservation in museums and environmental stewardship outdoors and gain business skills, including accounting, communications, and engineering. All fellowship positions are paid, and many offer transportation stipends, free on-site housing, or housing stipends. Applications available online at monoproject.org are due January 7th for work set to start next summer. Neuenschwander says the program has shown that increasing diversity strengthens federal agencies charged with managing lands owned by all Americans.
Teams that are working together thrive and are more successful when they're incorporating voices from people that have different upbringings and different backgrounds and different ethnicities.
Neuenschwander says putting these young leaders in uniform can also open the door for future generations.
So kids can realize, hey, I can be a park ranger one day, or, you know, hey, I can work at a national wildlife refuge and help others be introduced to the outdoors.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
Tribal leaders met with the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Holland, and Idaho tribes challenge redistricting plans. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Holland met with leaders from Great Plains tribes Friday in Rapid City. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Richard Tubles reports, tribal leaders discussed a number of issues facing their communities.
Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairwoman Janet Alkire is her tribe's first female chairperson in 50 years. She says Holland is the kind of person Indian country needs.
For us as Native people to have Secretary Deb Holland be there and be that voice and be the role model that we need, and me being a Lakota Mia, you know how proud I am to see another historic moment to have a woman sitting at the cabinet level and her being a Native woman.
Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Chairman Harold Frazier says he was satisfied with the dialogue.
It was just a message to them is that, you know, we can't forget the day-to-day lives of our people on the reservations. You know, we got how are we going to address the poverty? How are we going to address the poor health care and and just a bad infrastructure and things like that.
The president of the Ogallala Sioux tribe also attended. Kevin Killer says the meeting is a sign that the administration wants better relations with tribes.
I think the secretary kind of made that clear that it was important that she do that in her role. And that she wants to kind of continue helping us in different capacities.
Killer also says some tribal leaders asked for the return of the Black Hills, which is a sacred area in the traditions of many tribes.
You know, that's something that we're always making sure that it gets reiterated, but also making sure that you know, it gets up to the president, and I think the secretary is committed to carrying that message up there.
The meeting was organized by the Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association. In Rapid City, I'm Richard Tubels.
According to the Interior Department, Secretary Holland's meeting in South Dakota highlighted investments in Indian country, including $466 million for tribal projects and climate initiatives. Officials also met with Native youth taking part in the Lakota Nation Invitational. Idaho tribes are challenging redistricting plans in the state. As Eric Tigetoff reports, one map splits up the reservation.
The Shoshone-Bannock tribes are adding to a slew of legal challenges to Idaho's legislative voting maps. The Idaho Commission for Reapportionment approved new district maps for legislative and congressional seats in November, but tribal members say the map for the state legislature illegally divides the Fort Hall Indian Reservation in southeast Idaho. William Bacon is the tribe's lead general counsel. He says they want to have as many tribal members in one district as possible.
It's really straightforward. The Idaho Constitution and Idaho statutes protect communities of interest. The Fort Hall Reservation and the tribal people are a community of interest. We challenged the map that split the tribal community up into three different areas.
Communities of interest are groups with shared concerns that might be affected by legislation. Upon approval, the redistricting commissioners said the maps are well-balanced with little variance in population between districts. Devon Boyer, chairman of the tribes, says ideally the entire Fort Hall Reservation would be in one district.
The only way that Shoshone-Bannock tribes is going to feel as though we're being properly represented is by making sure that we're collectively in the same area with proper representation, just like anyone else would be.
The Idaho Supreme Court has combined two previous challenges to the maps and will hear oral arguments for those cases on January 14th. The Shoshone-Bannock tribes hope their challenge is added for oral arguments on that day. Another challenge has been filed to the congressional map as well, meaning all four cases could be heard at the same time. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Young people in the Bay Area are using hip-hop to demand climate action. The Hip-Hop for Climate Justice programs helps youth express their feelings about the problem. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Young climate activists march in the streets, lobby elected leaders, and make hip-hop. The Hip Hop and Climate Justice Initiative is a program of a Bay Area activist group called Youth vs. Apocalypse. Participants work together to write and perform songs and make videos demanding climate action. 20-year-old Dulce Arias helped start the program. She says climate change disproportionately harms low-income communities of color.
Our struggles are very real, and I feel like with music, it's a way to like express ourselves and kind of like heal ourselves in a way.
She says songs stick with people in a way speeches or articles often do not. So she says hip-hop can be an effective tool to get new people engaged in the fight for climate justice. The group's latest release, Where's the Money At?, calls out companies and leaders that continue to invest in fossil fuels.
Money spent just to bring the torture to our lives. Money spent just to see the tears in their eyes. Money spent to kill off and see us alone. Where's the money at? Because how could we know? Money for the
world. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Hannah Merzbach and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobunoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Sophia Muhammad, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means with host Joseph Gallivan. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.